Imagine a massive earthquake is about to hit.
Right.
Your survival actually has very little to do with like how fast you can run or how quickly you can dodge falling debris when the ground actually starts
Oh,
shaking.
absolutely. It has almost everything to do with how meticulously you built the walls of your house, 10 years ago.
Exactly, because we love to romanticize the panic of survival. We watch these movies and we think that resilience is entirely about, I don't know, adrenaline-fueled split-second decisions.
Right, the hero dodging the rocks. But true resilience isn't reactive at all. It's architectural.
Yeah. So, welcome to this custom-tailored deep dive. You are diving into a framework today that really just flips the traditional narrative of crisis management completely on its head.
It really does. Because our mission today is extracting this highly actionable, surprisingly modern strategy for, well, personal belief and resilience.
Yeah, and we are pulling this from Pastor Liggett's book, Great Woman, Great Faith. And what's fascinating is the author takes this deeply ancient text from 2 Kings 4.
The story of the Shunammite women, right?
Right. And he layers it with these visceral modern day anecdotes. So our goal is to really pull out the psychological and practical mechanics of preparation, mindset, and bold action.
And I want to point out, whether you are currently prepping for a high-stakes boardroom meeting, or maybe you're trying to navigate a profound personal loss, the underlying mechanics of how humans overcome adversity, they remain exactly the same.
Yeah, totally.
And the author anchors his whole argument in Hebrews 11.1. But he treats it less like abstract theology and more like a psychological blueprint. Faith, substance, hope, evidence.
Okay, let's unpack this because, starting with preparation feels a bit, I don't know, obvious at first glance.
Sure, yeah, like be prepared.
Right. But we aren't talking about writing a morning to-do list here. The framework defines preparation as the literal architecture of belief.
Yes, it is an active structural investment. I mean, look at the narrative of the Shunammite woman from the text. She doesn't just, casually welcome the prophet Elisha when he happens to pass through her town.
Yeah, she doesn't just point him to an old rundown shed in the backyard or something.
Exactly. She actively petitions her husband to construct a brand new, what she calls a little chamber, specifically for him.
And she furnishes it down to the exact details, like a bed, a table, a stool, and crucially, this is important, a candlestick.
Right. That candlestick is a massive focal point in the author's analysis
Hmm.
because it operates as this psychological metaphor for bringing light to chaos.
Okay, how so?
Well, think about your physiological response to a sudden power outage. Like during a severe thunderstorm, you were stumbling down a pitch black hallway, your adrenaline is spiking.
You stub your toe on the coffee table.
Yes, you stub your toe, it's deeply disorienting and stressful.
Hmm.
But the split second you find a flashlight or light a candle, what happens? Your heart rate drops.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
The environment hasn't physically changed. I mean, the storm is still raging outside, but your perception of the space is restored. You now have localized control.
Instant stabilization, the panic just evaporates simply because you can navigate the space. So the argument here is that without intentional preparation, without building the room and lighting the candle, you're basically opting to live in chaos.
Right. You're just waiting for the next stubbed toe. It's about establishing an environment for an unforeseen outcome. You're physically and mentally carving out capacity for an opportunity that honestly hasn't even materialized yet.
Which really makes me think about preparing for a major career leap. Like, you don't wait for the vice president title to drop onto your desk and then decide, oh, I should learn some leadership skills.
Exactly. That's way too late.
Right. You build the cognitive and professional room first. You don't give tomorrow's goals yesterday's effort. But let me push back a little bit
Sure,
here.
go for it.
Is building an empty room actually an exercise in faith, or is it just, speculative real estate? Because investing time and money into an opportunity that doesn't exist yet, that requires a terrifying amount of upfront vulnerability, you run the risk of looking entirely foolish.
You do. But that vulnerability is the exact mechanism that activates the framework. True preparation demands that you align your physical and mental environment, your personal temple, so to speak, with the reality you want to inhabit.
So it's forcing a change.
Yes, it forces a cognitive shift. You cannot expect a new outcome while stubbornly occupying an old space. You have to commit to the architecture first.
But, building a physical room is actually the easy part. I mean, the real friction hits when the opportunity you've been waiting for finally walks through the door and your own brain violently tries to reject it.
Oh, absolutely. This is where we move from the physical environment to the mental battleground,
yeah.
what the text defines as substance, or the subject matter of thought.
Right. Because the physical space is ready, but the internal programming is hostile to the new reality. Like when Elisha tells the Shunammite woman she is going to have a son.
She doesn't celebrate.
No. She immediately shuts him down. She says, "Do not lie unto thine handmaid."
It's a total immediate defense mechanism. You really have to examine the psychological weight she is carrying there. She had survived so many seasons of life without a child.
The author implies she had likely endured countless sleepless nights, mourning a future she eventually just had to grieve and let go of.
Right. Her brain had literally wired itself around disappointment to protect her from further pain. So when the promise finally arrives, it doesn't trigger hope. It triggers the trauma of past failures.
Wow.
Leggett categorizes this as the law of the cannot do's. It's that restrictive mental programming ingrained during childhood or through repeated defeats that just severely limits adult potential.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because those cannot do's map perfectly onto what we now call imposter syndrome, or, you know, negative cognitive framing.
Oh, 100%.
It's that insidious internal monologue insisting you aren't qualified, or that the good thing happening to you is a mistake, or that you're about to be exposed. And the author shares this deeply visceral anecdote showing that even seasoned professionals get paralyzed by this.
The hospital story. Yes, it vividly demonstrates how cognitive framing can override expertise. Leggett recounts being at Baptist Hospital with his lead pastor visiting the family of a dying man named Harold.
Right.
And the doctor walks into the waiting room and just delivers terminal news. He says, "There is nothing else we can do." And the room immediately descends into absolute despair.
And the lead pastor, in that moment, just turns to Leggett and tells him to lead the prayer.
Exactly. And Leggett experiences this overwhelming internal conviction that Harold is going to survive. But his immediate visceral response, sheer terror.
Because of the pressure.
Because of his self-preservation instinct. It's screaming at him to play it safe. Psychologically, the fear of public failure, the dread of declaring Harold will live only to watch him die moments later, almost forces him to offer a generic, quiet prayer and just escape the room.
The cannot-do programming is fighting for the steering wheel, but he overrides it. He speaks out loud to the room, audibly declaring Harold will recover, and Harold actually does recover.
He eventually returns to sing in the church choir.
Right, and I want to linger on the how here. Why does speaking it out loud matter so much? Because neurologically, vocalizing a commitment forces your brain to align with that reality. It bypasses the internal doubt loop.
Yes, it is a forced cognitive override. By vocalizing the outcome, he shatters his own paralysis. And the author provides another fascinating example of this disruption happening, but externally this time.
Oh, the mom and pop restaurant in Alabama.
Right. He is exhausted. He's at this restaurant and he feels a profound urge to speak to a random young couple eating nearby. And he almost talks himself out of it. He even retreats to his car.
But he forces himself back inside.
He does. He walks up and tells them, "God closed this door because he has a better plan."
And they just completely break down crying. They had just been fired from their jobs as youth pastors and were sitting there feeling utterly discarded.
Exactly. And observe this shift in power dynamics here. That couple was trapped in a cognitive frame of victimization. They believe they were failures, right?
Yeah.
Discarded by a church board.
Yeah, totally stuck.
But by intervening and reframing their disaster as a purposeful redirection, Leggett alters their subject matter of thought.
Mm.
They transition instantly from victims of circumstance to active participants in a larger strategy.
So the core argument is that your internal narrative literally dictates your reality. Holding on to the trauma of past hurts incapacitates your ability to recognize or accept future solutions.
Yes. Changing that cognitive frame is the absolute prerequisite.
But a shiny, positive mindset isn't the finish line, because eventually reality is going to forcefully test that mindset, which brings us to the concept of aggressive action, or what the author calls hope.
We so often strip the word hope of its utility. We reduce it to a passive wish, like crossing your fingers and just waiting.
Right, like I hope it doesn't rain.
Exactly. But in this framework, hope is defined as aggressive, relentless forward momentum when the systems you built completely collapse.
And the woman's system does collapse. The promised son grows up, he goes out to the field, suffers what sounds like a severe aneurysm or maybe heat stroke, is carried back to his mother, and dies right on her lap.
It's tragic. Her absolute worst nightmare, the very thing she was terrified of when she told the prophet not to lie to her, it comes true.
A catastrophic structural failure. If there were ever a justified moment to surrender to those cannot do's, this is it, right?
Absolutely. But notice her protocol. She doesn't arrange a funeral. She carries her son upstairs, places him on the bed in that specific room she built, shuts the door, and launches into a brutal 9-hour, 24-mile journey to Mount Carmel to locate Elisha.
She commands her servant to slack not, meaning drive the animals forward, do not slow down, do not stop for idle chatter. It is a terrifying level of focus.
And Leggett actually juxtaposes this ancient journey with a very modern story of maternal action. His own brother Wayne was kicked in the head by a horse as a young child. Severe head trauma, completely unresponsive. But their mother doesn't freeze in panic. She throws him into the car and speeds toward a hospital 30 miles away.
And then the car breaks down. I mean, you can't make this up.
The obstacles just compound. Yet, rather than accepting defeat on the side of the road, she rips a white piece of cloth, ties it to the antenna as a distress signal, flags down a stranger, and successfully gets her son to the emergency room.
Entirely fueled by the audacious prayer of a minister they encountered there. And Wayne survives with zero permanent damage. It is the modern manifestation of slack not.
Yes, it's the absolute refusal to accept a deadlock.
Which reminds me of the prison story in the book. Leggett is at Holman Correctional Facility, this notoriously violent maximum security environment.
Right.
He's serving food, and an unruly inmate is holding up the line, blasting a transistor radio pressed to his ear, shouting profanity, just completely ignoring everyone.
Now, most rational people in that specific environment would avoid eye contact and just hand over the tray. You do not agitate a volatile situation in a maximum security prison.
But Leggett forces a disruption. He puts a dessert on the tray and then snatches it back. He deliberately provokes a confrontation, telling the inmate to stop playing games.
We really have to dissect the psychology of that moment. Why does a confrontation work instead of escalating into violence?
Right.
Because later that night, the inmate runs to the chapel altar in tears. He confesses that the confrontation shattered his tough guy facade.
Yeah.
In that environment, that aggressive persona is a mandatory survival mechanism. But internally, it was causing profound psychological isolation.
So Leggett's sudden authoritative action broke the deadlock.
Exactly. It pierced the armor the inmate didn't know how to take off himself.
It's about refusing the superficial interaction and demanding the real one. And, you know, the Shunammite woman does the exact same thing when she finally tracks down Elisha.
Oh, with the staff.
Yes, Elisha's servant, Gehazi, tries to hand her the prophet's staff to take back to the dead boy, basically saying, "Here, take this magical stick, it'll hold you over." She flat out refuses it. She demands Elisha himself.
She won't take a substitute.
It's like trying to jumpstart a car with jumper cables connected to a battery that isn't plugged into anything. The cables, the staff are completely useless. She knows the proximity to the actual source of the power is what matters. She won't accept a proxy, like refusing to deal with a customer service chatbot when you absolutely need the CEO.
That's a great analogy. The clarity of her demand is crucial.
Yeah.
But we do need to address the inherent tension in this idea of relentless momentum, because slacking not sounds like a recipe for ultimate burnout.
Exactly. I want to challenge this because the framework insists on this aggressive forward drive. But elsewhere, the text acknowledges the absolute necessity of rest. So how do you, as the listener applying this to your own life, distinguish between a legitimate need to rest and simply using fatigue as an excuse to avoid the hard work?
It's a fine line.
Hmm?
But Leggett navigates this nuance brilliantly using the historical account of King David at Ziklag.
Oh.
David returns to his stronghold to find it burned to the ground and all the families taken captive. It's a devastating loss. David initiates a massive pursuit with 600 men to recover them. But during the forced march, 200 of those men hit a wall of absolute physical exhaustion.
They literally cannot cross the Bryphosor.
Right. They are forced to stay behind.
Now, in a hyper-aggressive culture, those 200 men would be branded as cowards or liabilities.
Some of the other soldiers actually try to cut them out of the recovered spoils later. But David intervenes and protects them. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the psychological takeaway here is profound.
What is it?
Hitting your physiological or mental limit and stopping to rest is entirely acceptable, provided the overall trajectory of the mission remains intact. Resting to recover capacity is strategic. Stopping because you've surrendered is failure.
Ah, love that.
True hope doesn't demand self-destruction. It demands commitment to the final outcome.
Okay. So she finishes the marathon, secures the profit, and we arrive at the final mechanism, evidence, and the manifestation of the breakthrough.
Yes. Elisha enters the room, stretches himself over the boy, and the boy sneezes 7 times and opens his eyes. the crisis is averted. But the critical data point in this narrative is the mother's immediate behavioral response.
Right. She doesn't just snatch up her son and run out of the room, which is what most people would do.
Exactly. She falls at Elisha's feet and expresses deep gratitude first. The author highlights a fundamental distinction in her operating system. She wasn't just extracting a miracle, she was honoring the source.
Her posture and attitude were in complete alignment with the outcome. So what does this all mean for us? The framework uses other historical figures to show how your posture fundamentally alters reality.
Like blind Bartimaeus.
Yes. Cool. Take blind Bartimaeus. He's sitting by the highway. When he realizes Jesus is walking by, he doesn't just rattle his cup and hope for some spare change. He physically throws off his beggar's cloak, which was essentially his legal license to beg, and actively asks for his sight.
We have to look at the power dynamics of that shift. Begging is inherently submissive. It reinforces a state of defeat and isolates you from agency. Asking, however, is an assertion of partnership.
It requires confidence.
Yes. By throwing off the cloak, Bartimaeus terminates his identity as a beggar and forces a new interaction.
That is such a vital distinction. Begging is broadcasting, "I have no power, please give me your scraps." Asking is stating, "I recognize my need and I am boldly engaging you to resolve it."
The author also explores this power dynamic with the Samaritan woman at the well. Jesus approaches her not with the cultural condemnation she expects, but with profound respect, offering her living water.
And that baseline respect completely short-circuits her defensive programming.
It alters the power dynamic from hostility to curiosity, which becomes the psychological evidence she needs to change her entire life trajectory.
The core thesis here is a complete inversion of how we normally think. Miracles do not produce faith. Faith produces miracles. If you're sitting in the dark waiting for a sudden flash of light to prove you should finally start building your room, you're going to be waiting in the dark forever.
Which is exactly why the framework warns so heavily against isolation. Look at the narrative of Peter. He successfully walks on water when focused and connected. But the moment he is isolated from his community later on, he completely collapses and denies his affiliations.
Wow. Yeah, isolation amplifies the cannot do programming. When you are alone, the echoes of your own doubts are deafening.
Remaining tethered to a community and acting with definitive authority, that is the mechanism that pulls evidence from the theoretical into reality.
This completely rewires how we should look at crisis management. It's not about how well you dodge the falling debris. It's a cohesive paradigm shift.
It really is.
It starts with intentionally architecting your environment, building the room for the opportunity before it exists. Then it requires violently defending your internal cognitive frame, refusing to let past trauma dictate your current potential.
Right.
When the inevitable collapse happens, it demands aggressive, relentless momentum while being self-aware enough to strategically rest. And finally, it means stepping out of the submissive posture of begging and boldly asking for the outcome you need.
And for you, the listener, the utility of this is immediate. Whether you are walking into a negotiation that will define your company's fiscal year, or you are quietly holding your family together through an unbearable private tragedy, the mechanics of resilience do not change.
No, they don't.
You are not defined by the severity of the earthquake. You are defined by the foundation you choose to pour today.
Which leaves us with one final, deeply provocative concept from the author's analysis. He talks about the power of making a decree in secret. He asserts that what you decree shall be established. So look at the landscape of your life right now. If your current reality, your career, your relationships, your stress levels is simply the manifestation of the silent, secret decrees you've been whispering to yourself over the last decade, what exactly have you been decreeing? And more importantly, the second this audio ends, what new decree do you need to make?